Okay. Item 9, consider take possible action regarding the interest crediting rate on member accounts. Kirk. Good morning.
Okay, so you might remember this item that was on the August meeting where we talked about the member crediting rate. There was a lot of discussion and a little bit of confusion. I wanted to go back a little bit in time to see exactly how we got this decision to the board. This came up when we did the kind of a educational presentation on the interest crediting policy and the excess earnings policy, where the member crediting rate is actually used. And we were asked who determines this member crediting rate, where does it come from? And so it is something that the board adopts. Within CERL, there's a section of CERL that says the board adopts the rate to credit member accounts. And I quoted a few sections here. I cited a few sections. It's the board's authority to do that. They can do a rate that's more or less than the assumed rate of return. They have discretion to do that. And this affects the money that the members have on account that accumulates. And it also affects what they're charged sometimes when they do a service purchase or a redeposit. When they withdraw their funds, later come back to work and want to redeposit them, they have to pay all that interest that would have been credited during that period. So they're either credited with it or sometimes charged it. When CERL was originally set up, this was something, the idea was these members are participants and they contribute towards their annuity, and the board would take specific action every 6 months to say, this is what we're crediting this time, this is what we're crediting this time, and they typically credited the same discount rate that's used in the valuation. Our board eventually adopted a policy where they simply would credit that rate. Now, what happened is in the 80s, when they shifted more towards equities and there was more volatile returns, there was some concern that they were crediting, and not only do they credit the member accounts, they credit their own reserves, the employer advance reserve, the retiree reserve. And it was clear that even with smoothing, there wasn't always going to be enough money to credit. We had these tiny little reserves that were set aside, contingency reserves that were set aside for years when we didn't have enough earnings. Well, those were only 1 or 2% of assets. That wasn't enough necessarily. In 1 year, you could simply not have enough money. So they switched their policy in the 90s. CSERA did, the board did, to credit the lesser of the assumed rate or what the actual earnings were on a smooth basis. And that stayed in place for the late 90s into 2000. And there was a little deficiency even with that. And in 2003, that's when they went to the contra tracking account. The idea was, well, in the contra tracking account, we're going to keep track of when we don't have enough earnings. We'll keep track of that on the side. And when we do have gains, we'll offset it. So with that mechanism in place, it was believed that they could credit their valuation reserves with the assumed rate of return always. And that included every single reserve, the member reserve, employer advance reserve, retiree reserve, each one. And in the meantime, we saw other systems doing different things. And we know at this time that there are systems that do something very similar to us. They do credit the full actuarial reserves with the full assumed rate and keep a contra tracking account on the side to keep track. But even within that structure, they might credit the member account with something less than the assumed rate of return and credit some other reserve with more. So we wanted to put that in front of the board to say this is where we're at, this is what the other systems are doing. Siegel put together a letter, which you saw in August, which kind of goes through all what other systems are doing, what your different choices are, why, what the reasoning is behind these different choices, what rationale you might use. We currently have an interest crediting policy that says we credit member accounts with the member crediting rate. The board adopted member crediting rate. We credit other reserves with the actuarial assumed rate of return. It doesn't really say that they're the same necessarily, although it was the board's intention at the time they adopted that policy that they would be the same. So we've been doing that. But at this time, we would like the board to again consider Siegel's analysis of what the different considerations are and adopt what they want as the member crediting rate for this. I forget what the specific action you took in August was, simply to table this item for a future board meeting. So any questions?
Scott?
So making sense of this interesting historical jumble, and it is interesting actually to see the history of going back to the
50s. It is a jumble.
50s, and it is a jumble. What do you recommend we do and why?
Well, I think Siegel's letter lays it out very clearly. There is a rationale for doing what we've been doing, for crediting the assumed rate of return. And there is a rationale for crediting something more like what the members would earn in a long-term account at a risk-free rate, since they don't have risk, arguably. I think the board has to look at these different possibilities and make their own decision on what it is they should do. I think we'd like a little bit clearer policy. What would be nice in an interest crediting policy is for it to say what exactly is the member crediting rate based on what. And further, I think we came into a kind of an interesting situation where our current policy was adopted, last amended in 2006. Okay, we haven't had excess earnings. We haven't had a lot of discussion about it. Several of these board members, probably more than half the board members, never saw that policy until this year when I kind of did a kind of a review of it. And the board was asking, some board members were asking in August when we presented the Siegel letter, why do we have to decide this? Why is this before us now? Well, I think what would be nice is a little bit more regular review of some of these policies so they don't get lost and we don't have board members come on that don't know what they are, and what the current policy may not reflect what the current board really wants to do.
Can't disagree with that. So but the recommendation is?
Well, I don't think it's really not Kurt's place to make a recommendation here. I mean, he's laid out the various options, and it's up to the board to, among ourselves, decide on those options. Karen?
It may be useful to talk about an example of how this actually takes place in real life. And the interest crediting rate applies when someone comes into our membership and then terminates. So if somebody leaves after, let's say, 3 years of service, they have in their account their member contributions, and they are entitled to receive a refund of those plus interest. And the interest that is being used currently is the assumed rate of return, which is 7.25. I don't know, Kurt, if you have an example for how much that actually is in terms of just the principal and the interest for someone who's worked for the county, let's say, for 3 years, then terminates and asks for a refund.
It's a lot better than my CD's doing, I'll tell you that.
I could certainly do a calculation, but I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay. So let's assume it's $40,000 in contributions, and to that we add 7.25 interest and give the member a check for that amount. What Kurt and the actuaries have done is give you information about what other systems have done in terms of what interest rate they're using. And legally, as the memo indicates, you do have the ability to pick a different interest rate for this purpose.
So part of the reason, for the, and it, again, like Karen says, the only members that it really impacts are the people who leave prior to being able to draw an annuity. Otherwise, they're not ever going to see any of that money, at least not broken out that way. And then the idea behind paying some interest rate is that when you come to work for the county, it's mandatory that you make contributions to retirement. So money is taken out of your check. If you then decide to leave before you vest for a benefit, you should receive some rate of interest on those contributions that have been involuntarily, let's say, taken out of your checks. The assumption rate, at least in my opinion, is higher than what it should be, and what this crediting amount should be. At least I think that a market rate, that if the money wasn't taken out of an employee's check and they could have put it in a bank or a savings account or a brokerage money market fund, you know, what could they have earned on it?
Here, let me tell you.
Yeah. But something to the effect like prime plus something is a much more reasonable rate, I think, than what we've been paying. I don't think the actual earning rate is an appropriate rate, because that could be, you know, 13% in the last year, or it could be a minus 28% on a given year. As far as what the fund actually earns isn't an appropriate rate. There's a second consideration as to if people were to either convert service time or purchase prior service time, what we've been using, they would still have to pay the assumed rate on those amounts, because essentially they're making up for the lost opportunity to the fund on contributions. So no matter what we do with regard to the crediting rate on the member accounts, that rate still needs the purchase purchase of time or conversion of service still has to be at the assumption rate. Ken, you had
Ken Westerman, Deputy Sheriff's Association. Kurt, I was just curious what the actual experience is or has been with respect to how many people have actually taken their money out. Is there a percentage of people? I mean, how often does this happen? And on the other two, what Brian was saying, Brian, I would somewhat disagree that they could put it in a savings. They could also invest that same money, and so they now have the choice to invest their money. And if they're a savvy investor, they could probably exceed 7.25%. So I think there needs to be some middle ground, because otherwise the system is profiting off of the members.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other part of it is, if they were to receive that money, it's going to be after tax money, so they're already down 30-40% on what the amount that went into their retirement. Yeah. In the back.
My name is Sherry Pella. I'm a Clump Fire employee and local 1230 member. I strongly have to speak against this. Our contribution rates for myself are 26.5% of my paycheck. If I continue to pay that throughout my career, if I retire at 30 years and it earns 7.25% interest, I will have $3,193,000 that was contributed and invested on my behalf with just solely my money, not the fire district's contributions at all. If I get a 1% raise every single year throughout my career, along with step raises and promotional raises, I would retire at a salary of $155,000 at 90%, which would be $140,000 payout my first year. That 7.25% interest on that $3,193,000 is a $220,000 return on 7.25%. So right off the bat, you guys are earning $79,800 of interest on money that I put in on my behalf. So I'm losing money the whole time with our contribution rate of 26.5%. It is in my best interest when I retire to cash out, especially depending on my life expectancy. If I have some sort of illness or ailment, if I'm gonna possibly pass away at 70 or whatnot, my spouse will get 60%. You guys will continue to earn way more money than what I contributed it in on interest alone. So I'm better off cashing out my money and passing it on to my family. I got spreadsheets to prove it. I've had conversations with Kurt about this last year, and he agreed with me. So you guys are here to make decisions in the for the employees' best interest. This decision is not for our best interest. It's a huge takeaway. Because a lot of our members are looking at possibly cashing out their retirement benefit, basically quitting and cashing it out and rolling it over into an annuity and drawing on that when they do retire. If you guys basically do this, it forces a lot of us to look at other employment options because we're just giving away money at our current amount that we have to fund a retirement system.
How has this been different, though, than over the past years? I mean, why aren't more safety people, for example, doing this?
Because this took effect in 2002 when the rates went, basically the contribution rates went 350, took place, and the funding policy, and us agreeing.
It's the additional 9% that they bargained to pay, was at the time the full cost of switching to 3% at 50. So at the time, as people retired, this didn't mean they had a whole lot of money in there, extra money. But for people hired then, I don't know if the intention was ever that they would pay this extra 9% their entire career. Mm-hmm. The deputy sheriffs bargained that extra amount away. What this highlights is these efforts that some employers are taking around the state to try and have the member pay for the UAL, basically. And the situation that could happen is, oh, sure, the member's dumping all this money and then terminate and take it all out. And they don't pay down the UAL. So, I mean, the extra 9% that they're paying is what I see as the problem.
Mm-hmm. Karen? Harvey and Karen, does this happen? I mean, I got that under Karen, because I actually did what Karen was talking about in my way early career, never knowing I'd come back to county work after 4.5 years. But is it legal at once you reach retirement age to say, oops, I'm out of here before I, do they have the option to say the lump sum, they can take the lump sum?
Yes. Okay.
They give up retiree health, I think. They don't qualify for?
Correct.
That's right.
Well, again, we have to look at the best interest of the entire group as opposed to one employee group.
Harvey? Well, on behalf of the board, I wonder if we could take advantage of our actuaries in terms of giving us some commentary on what their assumption is that's worked into our plan as to how many people will terminate and withdraw. As Paul knows, this has been one of the most controversial subjects in the actuarial community over the last decade and a half, and got a lot of actuaries into trouble because they were assuming that people would do the counterintuitive thing, which is serve a large part of their career and withdraw and take their money with them. That proved to be, I'll say in the vernacular, insane assumption, because nobody in their right mind would do that. But I kind of, if we have, I mean, to put you on the spot, but I think the experience would be useful for people.
Yeah, I'd like to know about it, because I can't believe
people actually do this, especially late in their career.
I mean, as John walks up, the first thing is that we do tune up this assumption every 3 years. And so, you know, while I can't, John can recite maybe the actual rates better than I can, but it is an experience-based assumption. And if we started to see a pattern of the kind of late career cash outs, then we would hold them in the assumption. I don't know if we've seen that yet, but I'll let John comment on that.
As far as the assumption is concerned, is we pretend like everybody is an actuary and does the calculation and takes the greater present value of the lump sum of the refund or the present value of the annuity. Okay, so we're not understanding anything here clearly. Okay, so
let me elaborate on that for a second. That means that if someone actually made the choice that the officer mentioned
there would be an actuarial gain, because we're assuming that if the lump sum, if the contribution is bigger, we're assuming they're going to take that. So that would be a break even. But if it turns out that the spreadsheet's wrong, and that by taking the contributions out, they're actually giving up a benefit that's worth more, well, we were assuming that they were going to take the benefit that's worth more, which means there would either be, so that would be a gain. So we're already positioned where, when that decision is made, it's either break even, that's if we agree with their spreadsheet, I'm picking on your spreadsheet, right? If we agree with the spreadsheet, or if our computer disagrees, then that would actually show up as a gain.
So do we know what the current assumption is that you're using in the valuation that board just approved?
Yeah.
What is the current assumption for
that's
how many
the question.
People are going to terminate?
What's the experience?
And think that they're going to do better with that, it's in that bargain than...
Oh, at those higher ages?
Yeah. Do we give 7.25% back now on anybody who... What do we give for interest
yes.
now?
Yes,
7.25.
Okay. So the question before the House is, what was the last three-year review experience study? What did it show? I think that's the narrow question that's been asked here.
How many retail?
Yeah, and that's going to be hard to answer. I'd have to look back at the report. We value everybody, and we do just what we said. We look at which one is greater. I don't know how many people it's greater for, you know. I mean, it's buried way back in the program.
Yeah. Or how many have done it.
And we want to know how many have done it.
So in the last year, 110 people took a refund from active status, and 82 people took one that were already terminated. So about 200 people took a refund last year,
right,
so not a lot.
I'm curious as to how close they were to retirement versus the five-year person that got a job in another jurisdiction.
They're generally the five-year person.
Mm-hmm.
Our financial statements break out refunds separate from, to answer Ken's question, our financial statements break out refunds separate from retirement allowances. So we see that number in there. We know how much we're paying out, and we could split it up and find out how much is their contribution and how much is interest.
John, let me ask, in your experience, what today's annuity rate would be at an insurance company? Basically, the concept here is that it's a present value based on 7.25. Either way, you couldn't get anything close to 7.25 today from an insurance environment. You'd be in the 2-3% type range, and that would produce a far lower number than would 7.25. And I want to say my own view is that marketplace assumptions are the right ones to use. Picking those is not easy, but I like starting at, say, a 10-year treasury as the kind of number that is appropriate for us. But in any event, if we're comparing cash out lump sum versus staying in the plan, that comparison has to be taking that lump sum, putting it into a contract with an insurance company and getting whatever that insurance company will pay in the form of a life annuity or annuity equivalent to what the plan offers, paying for that. And 7.25 at the insurance company level is not an appropriate number.
Well, we've got a couple different calculations going on here. I mean, the question of whether an individual member thinks they'd be better off to take a refund of their contributions with 7.25% interest or to take the benefit of the plan, again, we test that within our program, but even with the 9% subvention, you know, you are going to be very hard pressed. If the idea is that you're going to take that lump sum out and then go out and buy an annuity rather than getting your benefit through the plan, even with the subvention, you're going to be hard pressed to do better with an insurance company that's going to be giving you a 4-5% interest built into that price, as opposed to taking the benefit out of the plan.
And there's no COLA on that.
There's no COLA.
Well, yeah, very hard to find commercial annuities. So if it's a matter of the member taking the money out and doing something with the money, investing it, structuring it their own way, that's a choice that they might think they could do better. But I think you're going to be hard-pressed to go to the commercial annuity markets and buy a larger annuity. I haven't checked the numbers, but to actually try to do that with commercial annuities, we'd have to price the market, and the market's going to be pretty severe against you.
And I would say that we also do a calculation at retirement. We know the members' contributions with interest, and we know what their benefit is. And if, in our spreadsheet, the members' balance is worth more than their formula, they actually get more. we actually pay them their full annuity. You know, it's the benefits are broken out into an annuity and a pension, an employer-paid pension. If the employee's contributions, which does happen occasionally, are worth more than their entire benefit, their annuity is, the employer-paid portion is essentially negative. They get their full annuity from us at 7.25%.
Yes, but you're looking at changing that to a market value of 2.5% or whatever, so that number is going to be drastically smaller.
Not at retirement, though. You're saying
the smaller rate
yes.
is applied during
sure.
accumulation, so you'd have less to spend.
Yes.
But then when you spend it, you would be buying an annuity at the 7.25%. But you're right, but the chances of being better off are going to be a lot lower if you've been accruing at a market rate. That is true.
Go ahead, you bet here.
So, you were asking about experience, how often does this happen? This obviously really hasn't happened because members went in 2002 from paying 7-9% in their retirement to basically 25-27% in their retirement. So, all the members from 2002 on that got hired around that time that potentially may be paying this throughout their career. You know, and looking at retiring 15 to 20 years down the road from now, are going to have that large amount of money they invested. The employee that got hired in the 90s and 80s that retired around 2000 or even 2008 and 9 that only paid into the system at that rate for 6 or 7 years, it's totally not worth it.
Well, we're going to review this before another 15 years too, but again, and I recognize your point, but I got to look at everybody. I can't just look at one group. And
it's not just Pond Fire.
But that, no, but your point is well taken. With the role here of the board is we're fiduciaries of the system for the benefit of all the members. And while microeconomic examples or individual examples can be helpful to understand someone's individual point, from the overall, the issue, the question before the House here is, what's the system effect of the rate we apply to banked funds that may or may not be withdrawn? What's the experience as it affects the entire system? That's, I understand the question before the House, right? That's the issue. Am I right, Kurt?
Yes.
Okay.
And your recommendation is, you didn't give us a year, but we need to review this maybe every 3 to 5 years, or, okay, I'm seeing a sour face from Paul.
I think as far as this is a plan design issue.
Yeah.
And I think that, you want to leave that fairly stable because the members want to know they can count on the deal. That was the only reason for my sour face.
That's and I appreciate that. So you've given us examples here. So the actuarial investment return assumption is what we're doing now. We're in that 6.
Yes.
Well, and then Jim. So when the employer has a rate, what are they credited? 7.25. They take money out and hold it. Like if they have to pay something that's due, no, there's no rate.
They can't take money out.
No, take money out. But if they pay something that's
their reserve account is credited at 7.25 at the assumed rate.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, ultimately, it's credited at the lower of 7.25 what's actually earned,
It's not okay. It's credited at the assumed rate, but if we don't earn the assumed rate, we increase our contribution. Right. So
yeah.
You talk about what's being credited or what's being charged.
Right.
Well, in terms,
I mean, they only get the actual return.
Yeah. I don't want you to think that because that the contra account means that somehow they're being credited with more than we earn. They are not. It's all just how you track it.
Right.
They are credited with the lower of what we actually earn or 7.25.
Mm-hmm. And then if an employee comes back on to purchase time, the interest rate that they're going to have to pay against that time is 7.25 at the assumed rate.
Yeah, there's a. It's
okay. And then the employers, so let's say the employee leaves, like we were talking about in the situation, as you said, microeconomics, the situations that we're talking about. The employer's contributions to their currently right now for some employers is 60, 70, 110%. So what happens to that money?
Stays
in the system. So then it would actually be a gain, as you mentioned, right? To somebody leaving, like if somebody cashes out, all that money that was accounted for that one employee.
But the assumptions are that some people do terminate, do withdraw, and take their money out, and because of that assumption, the employer rate's a little bit lower than if we didn't have that assumption. So when somebody leaves, that money goes to pay the people that didn't leave.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's built into the cost in advance.
Right.
So it's only if more people quit than we expected that you get a gain or a loss.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, the employees have no choice. They're mandated to contribute this money. So why wouldn't we give them what is fair, which is the assumed rate? We're assuming the rate for everything, every other action or money that we have in the account for the employers is all assumed rate of return. Why would we give them less and then ask them to pay more if they come back and purchase years? I just don't see that as being fair to the employee. And to your point, Scott, about thinking about the whole system, you're thinking that we're here for fiduciaries of the system. Well, the system's here for the employees, and it's the employees' retirement system.
I agree. I said so, it's for the benefit of all the members. It's here for the employees.
To talk about it being a micro, just a certain example, the examples of people leaving early are non-vested members, is my guess. The five-year members, the ones that leave and terminate out.
Yes.
There's no history or precedent of employees like myself contributing 27% of my salary to the pension. So I think it's in the best interest of the employee to continue to continue this rate, the assumed rate of return at 7.25.
And we're going to have like minds disagree here, but you get a better benefit also with the 3 at 50 than the other general members. So, and I wasn't on the board, and we didn't make this decision about, but we all know that we're in contract negotiations, and at some point that subvention is going to go away. So that's not going to be there for another 20 years. So all I'm saying is I have to look at the reason that the safety members are paying more is they have a better benefit. That's just the facts.
I'm not talking about safety. I'm talking about all members. I think all members should have this.
But I would argue that it's the safety members who may be the ones that pull their money out closer to retirement because they've put more in than general members.
Right.
That's my assumption, and that's where I'm coming from on my decision.
And on that employer, on that pool, I think it's that employer's responsibility to deal with that issue. But I think all the employees should have the right to get their money back at 7.25.
That's fine.
Yeah, Brian, first, something that you said regarding money going in the employees is tax-free. I really don't think that has any relevance to this board.
The only reason I made that point was if you're going to take the money, if they were able to take that money,
then you're going to get taxed.
And invest it.
Okay, but by putting that out there, that has an influence on this board. Yeah, their money's going in tax-free, so maybe we can lower their...
Well, I didn't interpret what Brian said to be tax-free.
That's not what he said.
I don't think
that's not what he said.
I'm not talking to you, Deborah.
Okay. Well, I'm not talking to you either.
So I don't think that what happens to the members' money before you get it is really of any concern to the board. It really shouldn't be part of your decision-making process. To something that John said, it is true, if you invested that money in an annuity, in an insurance company, yeah, you're going to get a lot lower interest rate. But those insurance companies are corporations, they're private entities, they're responsible to their shareholders. Of course they give a lower interest rate because their whole goal is to make a profit. They know that whatever interest rate they're paying, they can earn more money on that than the interest rate they're paying out. That should not be the approach that this board takes. That they're trying to make a profit, like an insurance company, off of the members' contributions. It should be a break-even proposition. We go through a huge exercise trying to determine what the assumed rate of return is going to be, because we're looking for that point where, over a long period of time, it's going to balance out to that number as far as return on investments. And to pick a number that's lower than that, to pick a number that you think you're always going to hit, something lower than the 7.25 or whatever number you guys decide, is saying we expect to make a profit on these members' contributions. And that should not be the consideration of this board.
Jerry? Yeah, Deborah, I thank you for bringing this up. It brought a clearer picture for me for what the issue is and hearing it. I think, didn't you bring this up like 2 months ago and wanted to have this issue? I thought this was the issue.
It might have been in the actuarial evaluation discussion.
I'm going to go back to Siegel, and I'm going to go back to what you said earlier, Kurt, about you not wanting to make a recommendation, wanting to explain what it is, but also stating that Siegel, in their letter, has stated a position that you, I think, would be favorable to. And that position is that we do not change anything because it, and I'll go to the last line, overall the change to employer rate and refundability factors due to these effects are de minimis considerations. So why put us through and why put our employees through all that work that would require if we changed it, and it would be added work for that for them. And you're saying, Siegel, that it's not a huge change if we change it or don't change it. So I'm of the opinion that we stay where we are and we just stay on the ship and ride it for another 3 years and come back. If it doesn't look like it's working, change it. But for right now, it seems to be working. So why change what's already working?
Is that a motion?
So my motion is to go ahead and keep it as it is and just move on.
I'll second that.
Paul, do you know of any systems that there's a distinction between vested members and non-vested members and defundability?
No, there, not to my knowledge. Wasn't there one system that actually, I don't think it was a 37 action, where they had they actually did two calculations so that if a member did not withdraw when they got to retirement because they wanted to have the right amount transfer over, they recalculate the reserve.
Yeah, they calculate the member's annuity on one rate,
right,
but a withdrawal on another rate. And that kind of comes from a SERL statute that allows the board to basically have a withdrawal charge for people that refund.
Right, but that would have the same effect on the members as adopting the more market-based rate, because
exactly,
that's what's used for withdrawals. It's just once the member retires, they decide they're not going to take their money out. In terms of the internal accounting, in order to have something be more consistent, I am waving my hands here both physically and metaphorically, then there's an adjustment that's made. We know of one system that does that. But I'm not really sure that that's worth the trouble, but that's not the point here. So, no, we do not know of one that, as far as the rate that the member would see, really has two different rates operating. Not in practical terms. I don't think so, Kurt, even in that example.
No, I mean, we could look at, I guess, the possibility of withdrawal charges for non-vested members, but
no, we're not gonna do that.
As another approach.
Are we doing discussion?
Yeah, there's a motion on this.
And I just wanted to say the reason I said that this motion is based on our actuarial's recommendation, that it really doesn't make a matter one way or the other. I'm glad we've had this discussion. I think it brings it out, as Scott mentioned, and we've had individuals comment on how this affects them. It doesn't make that big of a difference to the system to leave it where it's at. So that's why I'm seconding the motion.
I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Jerry.
No, I was just going to say, Jerry, I wasn't aware of that situation. How much safety members were contributing, particularly fire. But I wasn't aware of that calculation of that benefit. So I'm glad you brought that up. That does change my mind with regard to this issue, because it does have a significant impact. Whether or not in the long run it would make sense for you to cash out and attempt to find a private annuity, that's something to be determined. But
yes, I want to have that option. I want to be able to provide for my family as best as I can down the road.
Absolutely.
That is an option for me.
Okay. Thanks for bringing that to at least my attention. Rusty?
I'm still thinking about everybody's comments here. And again, I'm also wondering too, if you have explanation behind the ones here on the sheet, the chart, why they went to another interest credit program than one we're using. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard the arguments, and I haven't really heard one today that's very convincing. I mean, I can sympathize, but again, we don't live in an absolute world. We don't always earn 7.25 or 8.5 the way it was several years ago. Tomorrow we may be changing our rate down to 6.5. Mm-hmm. Who knows what?
But I get that this fluctuates down if we do that. It doesn't stay at 7.25.
No.
It would go with...
I understand that. So there's no guarantee in the rate to the gentleman back here or anybody else what it might be when they finally retire and want to pull the money out of the system. I go back to the mission of this system in the first place. It's to provide annuities for the rest of your life once you retire. Okay, it's a guaranteed payment, regardless of what we actually earn along the way. It's a benefit that I can rely on as a certain amount, plus COLA, for until I die, or and then pass it on to my wife. And I don't know if by allowing somebody to retire and pull out their money at the rate of 7.25 does or does not actually impact the system. Depends on how much money they're actually earning. If they figure they put in over $3 million, and then what's the interest rate going to be on that? Will it have a negative impact on the system? I'd be curious to see the numbers on that. But anyway, I'd like to hear some more explanations on why these other systems chose to go a different route than the one we've taken.
Well, yep. If you go in Siegel's letter to page 2, because it not only has the table that Kirk put in his letter, but it also has sort of the board policy question, because that's, I think, is the way to try to get in the minds of other boards that have visited this. We've been talking here mainly, you see the Roman 1 in parentheses and Roman 2. We've really been talking here only about Roman 1. And that is, should the member crediting rate be based on the assumed earnings rate or based on a market rate? And you had sort of the, I think Mr. Chairman Haas started with the standard argument for using a market rate, you know, because that's what they'd be able to get if they were out there. We're not supposed to be a savings plan. That was balanced by the gentleman who said that especially, at least in theory, because I don't think this has happened yet, right? But in theory, because of the high contribution rates, you could have people who, you know, are counting on that 7.25 in order to actually give them a viable choice with this large portion of their income that they've now been forced to save in the plan. So that's all we talked about so far. I think the systems that went with a market rate, and it shows four of them, did this on a philosophical basis, and it's exactly in keeping with your comments that this is an annuity plan, this is not a savings plan, and you know, we shouldn't be giving people a savings rate that's higher than they could possibly get in the market. I will comment on the other comment that was made about fairness. That comment did not take into account risk. The only way that this system is able to assume 7.25 is because if they don't earn 7.25, they can go to all the people, meaning mainly the employers and the members, and collect more money from them. Whereas once you agree to credit this rate at 7.25, there's no way to get that money back from the members. And so it's not quite as unfair as it may seem. It may seem like the plan's making money on those contributions, but the plan is taking on a risk that the members are not taking. So you have to mention the R word. You have to think about risk on that part. But I think the ones that went to the market rate, it was philosophically, if they're going to treat us like a savings plan, then we're going to give them a rate like a savings plan. And I think that's really where that conversation goes. And what I've heard so far is, based on the motion and second, is that you would say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go ahead and treat this money the same way we treat all of our other monies. Now, the other item that hasn't been discussed, and I do not mean to disrupt the fact that a motion's already been made, the other possibility that some of the systems said was, okay, well, we like crediting at whatever our assumed rate is, but this really happened after the 2000 tech bubble burst, where because of smoothing, we had a series of years where the actual earnings on a smooth basis was less than the assumed rate, right? They had those losses come in. And there the systems were saying, well, we like the idea of crediting the same as we're assuming, but if we have a bad patch where we're only earning 5% or 6% on a smooth basis, should we still be crediting the full 7.5, whatever it was, in those years? And that led to systems doing what I think this system used to do, which is to credit the lesser of the assumed rate or what the system actually earned on a smooth basis. So at least in a year when you're not earning the full assumed rate, in those years you would only credit the amount that you actually earn.
The reverse argument, so it makes more than 7.25. Right. It's making 8.
I'm waiting for you for that one, Jerry. Here's the answer to that. it's because you can't take money out of the member's account. Okay. What that approach does, it says we're actually crediting you what we earn, mm-hmm. with a cap of the assumed rate, but with a floor of 0. And the fairness is, when we earn 20, you only get 7.25. Right. But when we lose 5, we're not taking it out of your pocket. So I think that's why it's viewed as relatively fair to say to have a cap and a floor. Now, that's not what the motion is, but that's what the second number two. And that really is a separate question. If you've decided to stay with something tied to the actuarial earnings, then you have a separate question, which you do not need to change. Would be, do you want to go back to your earlier policy of basically never crediting more than you earn on a smooth basis? That is not the motion on the table.
Well, okay. I seconded this based on the fact that Siegel's recommendation is there was not significant financial advantage. And so if there wasn't significant, I was willing to leave it alone. But with that second argument, okay, three.
Why are you doing this?
Well, no.
I'm still going to.
We need to have this conversation.
Yeah. No significant financial advantage comment applies to both. Okay, it is more of a perception. Just like the first one was a perception that we don't want to be a savings account, the perception that, gee, when we earn less, we better give them less. That's because that's what you feel you ought to do, not because it's really going to change the cost.
Okay, and I get that. But as the gentleman from Confire said, this probably won't. Safety members aren't going to realize their benefits till 10, 15 years down the road. I would venture that the board, not us personally, will take this up again within that 10, 15 years. So, okay, I'll leave my second in place.
There you go.
Scott and then Jim.
Did someone else have their hand up before?
Jim over here.
Go, let him go.
To be fair, I would personally have no problem with this board crediting an interest rate each year, whatever the board earned.
But that's what he's saying. We can't do the upper.
Well, to somehow arrive at a policy that would accomplish that goal. I'm not looking to rip the fund off either. I'm just saying that we've arrived at an expected rate of return that over the long term will balance out to that number. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll balance out if each year you can credit whatever the board earns, over the long term you're going to see 7.25%. So, you know, if the board could somehow arrive at a policy that would accomplish that's fair.
And my only follow-up is because by law you can't do that, because if the border, if you earn less than 0, you can't take it right. back. You can't really credit exactly what's earned every right. year. Right. So the trade-off, the standard trade-off is to say, right. well, then cap it at the assumed rate.
Yes.
Again, but that's, you know, that was your earlier policy. I really do not mean to say, oh, you got to take back the current motion, but in order to make sure, as long as we're talking about it, that all the possibilities are out there, that is what some other systems did.
But you know, you bring this up now. Why was this not explicit in your memo, and why did you say that it would be de minimis considerations? It sounds like what you're now talking about as a more favorable position for this board would not be de minimis, would involve more considerations in doing more for staff and for this board.
He said other boards have done it. It's a philosophical.
Yeah. I was asked what other boards have done. Mr. Tellis, on page 2, we lay out the 3 choices. And at the end, we say they're all de minimis.
Okay.
And that we really did not mean to pull back from that at all. It's just because your discussion focused on one of the things and not the other ones. If it's going to be comprehensive, we just want to make sure you know that, again, because we were asked what other systems do, that's the complete story for you.
I got it.
Okay, so I'm going to make a governance comment, I guess, and a general comment. I remain somewhat perplexed by the fact that on an issue such as this, the matter is thrown solely to the board in its discretion to make a decision. and in this case, we don't have a recommendation. Forget for the moment that apparently this is a de minimis matter we're spending an hour on, and that I wasted time over the weekend reading about. I've listened to impassioned debate and sometimes inappropriate debate about it today. But from a governance standpoint, it's difficult for anybody to sit here, whether you've been here a year and a half or 6 months or whatever the time frame is, and to not have a recommendation that has either specific options or a choice set with it with a rationale. If you want to leave it all up to us and me, not a problem, because apparently that seems to be the status quo, or maybe that's we've always done it that way. I don't know. But I'm just evidencing a frustration that from the standpoint of reading packets over the weekend, digesting your report, which is very thorough and which has a wealth of information in it, it takes a lot of time to assimilate this. So if you're going to put somebody out on a boat without a rudder, you get what you get, is my statement to all of us. So it almost has an ad hoc feel at times that we're going to talk about what everybody does, but we're not going to say why we think we should do what we should do. If ultimately it's because we make the decision, so be it. There's 1,000 other boards that do it differently, that actually have something that comes before it that has a different vetting and a different posture and a choice set. So I'm evidencing a frustration. I guess I'm partly annoyed because this seems to be an immaterial, non-material matter with respect to the impact on plant assets. But we're talking about it a lot. So I'm just, my governance comment is, I don't even want to vote on this motion. I usually chide electeds who avoid votes and abstaining for that reason. But in this instance, I just feel like the posture of the issue, I don't care if it's not material, it isn't in a shape where I feel confident I can vote on it. I mean, of all the things I heard today, I think Rusty said it best for me. We're in the business of providing secure annuities for retirees so there's certainty with that there's money there when they retire, and that if something happens to them, that their spouse is taking care of their family. That's kind of it when you strip it away. So I actually am more inclined to the choice that Paul Angelo spoke to, which was the lesser of our prior policy, having just kind of listened and reacted to it here today. So I'm perplexed amongst the choice set, disappointed that we don't have a different posture. And my last comment is I'm a little concerned about the increasing angst in some of the debate that occurs, particularly as it relates to the interaction between the public and board members. I'm concerned about that. And I think that First Amendment can be what it is, but you have to have a debate in a civil way, or else you're going to lose the message. So I'm currently thinking about abstaining on this motion.
Actually, we can leave it alone, and if the motion can be withdrawn, because this just says consider and take possible action, and we currently have a policy in place. It's been explained to us. I think we're much more informed now on it, and either we can choose to vote on it, or basically what we're doing is confirming our current position, so I'm not sure that we need to take any action unless there is reason to change it.
I'll pull my motion off the table.
And I'll pull my second. And I agree with Scott's comments about...
I'm not comfortable because other stuff has surfaced after... So I'm pulling my motion.
Okay. Any other discussion on this item? Okay. We'll move on.